have 20 dB of quiet in or 12 dB of quiet in at half a microvolt, and you make a measurement, and you find out the receiver has a sensitivity of 5 microvolts instead of 0.5 microvolts, 10 to 1 in voltage higher, which by the way happens to be 20 dB. In other words, your receiver, if it measured 5 microvolts of sensitivity when it's supposed to be half a microvolt, you know that there's a 20 decibel error somewhere. There's a low noise amplifier that's blown out and not working. There's a relay that's not making good contact between transmitter and receive. Maybe you've got the signal generator set to the wrong frequency, or you got the receiver set to the wrong frequency. So when you start measuring great big differences in sensitivity between what should be, according to the manufacturer, versus what you really do measure, it's time to start doing some troubleshooting. And by signal tracing techniques, if you've got a good signal generator that can go to various frequencies, you could start injecting the signal downrange in the receiver into the IF strip and find out if the IF strip has got the right sensitivity. And then start working your way back toward the front end, going through the mixer, and find out if it has the right amount of local oscillator on the right frequency, and so on. So receivers are fun things to troubleshoot and measure. It's a bit of a learning curve, but it's a darn good thing to know. KC2WGB, K2IIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I'm sure that'll give him a little advantage, and I do believe he has a synthesized generator. He mentioned it's a good quality HP generator, and it's not the old one. So I think he should do well with that. And that'll give him something to play with. Good for him. All right, it's after 10. I think we should go to Paul for the space report. And I thank you kindly. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
KC2FYK, quick question.
Go right ahead, Harry.
I'm just wondering if you're concerned about that signal being radiated by the signal generator. Couldn't you take care of that by grounding the cabinet of the signal generator? Oughtn't it to act as a Faraday cage? And if it's in a plastic housing, couldn't you put it inside of a metal box that's grounded and take care of it that way?
I think the answer, Harry, is almost no. Very few self-respecting companies will build a signal generator in a plastic box. Almost everybody builds a signal generator in a metallic box. When you look at the mechanism by which leakage from that metallic box takes place, you'll find out, oh, am I going into the wrong antenna? No, I'm going into the right antenna. Okay. The leakage from that metallic box is taking place from the feed-through capacitors that feed B-plus into it, how well sealed are the six sides of the box in all of the corners, whether or not some of the signal is leaking out through the front panel dial or the feeder on the front end. The signal can leak out in all kinds of funny ways from a metallic box. And by just adding a ground wire on the outside of that metallic box, will that really change the amount of leakage? The answer is almost no. It will have an extremely minor effect. So the word grounding, when it comes to RF circuits, takes on some very peculiar meanings. So grounding the steel box, I don't think it's going to help much. Putting another box around it, people have done that. That works, but that's a lot of work. It's got to be a six-sided box where all six sides are making very good contact along all of the edges. You can see it's a pretty heroic effort to do that and still have a front panel knob that you can get to. What if that makes some sense, Harry? KC2FYJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it does. Thank you.
I'm a little bit curious as to how the signal from John and Harry can be in this machine so much louder than mine. Maybe I don't have the direction of the antenna set right. Maybe I'm off on one of the side lobes. Because the darn antenna rotator I'm using has the zero has its position in the wrong place. It means 0 degrees due south. So it takes some mental mathematics that I haven't solved yet. How in the world are you getting such a strong signal into this repeater, John? KC2WCB for a quick answer before I go over to Paul. KQISW for Tech Man.
Dick, I have a little question. It's real quick. It won't take time.
Dick, I'm on the 125, and Eric did make a comment that he has a 3 dB loss in that coupling on the eastern. Might be the problem.
That makes sense. So,
both are going to be coming in on
yep, I see. Except for the delay on 125, now I know why you're coming in so quiet. And therefore, because you're coming in that way, I wasn't doing enough repeating, so the guys on IRLP are getting the message. N2 moves on. K2RIW, go ahead, Barry.
Okay, it won't take long. When you were discussing cooling and heating with gases and liquids, mostly gases, you never brought up electronic coolers. Are they totally different, or is there something similar about the way they work? You know, the transistorized flat panel electronic cooler things.
Signal is all noise, 21 IFL.
Okay, stand by a second, Barry. Eric, I wonder if you got that message. I think somebody on IRLP or Echo Link is telling us something. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
No, I didn't hear him, but that would definitely Echo Link.
The person at Echo Link, I think you're telling us that some of the message is dropping out, and yes, we sort of know that. We're doing a workaround tonight. Because there is a very strong signal on our main input frequency that's giving us grief. The person on Echo Link, go ahead and repeat your message. K2RIW, the tech man.
I had that earlier. I was listening to you doing. Yeah, it should be the only time I'm here, and I'm doing it again in 1 hour. You say, what's up, that man?
The person who just gave us an Echo Link message, your audio was a little bit heavy, you were dropping out of the machine, and therefore we were only hearing every other syllable, and therefore couldn't put the message together. Speak quite a bit more softly and give us that message again. KQRIW listening.
I'm saying that I'm only hearing you, but I'm not hearing anyone else. You just said it was very fast. I'm just listening.
Anybody else,
boys?
When John comes through the UHF, he doesn't hear him. That's just the way it is. And you might try going back to normal for a little while.
Roger, Dodger. Stand by. Hello, 1-2. And if I aim the antenna in the right direction, I'll get a little stronger. However, I don't know if we're going to be able to hear. Yes, we will be able to hear other people. I'm in the process of re-aiming the antenna, which I think I've almost got in the right position. Alrighty. This is the TechNet, KQRIW speaking. You're hearing a header guy in the background because of a strong signal that is stuck on. I can tell by the sound I was hearing, somebody has a stuck microphone. I don't think it's intentional jamming, and the person doesn't know about it. Bob, WS2M, my way of 975-375, everybody will be able to hear you, so give us our space report, Paul.
That signal is definitely a signal strength that is a problem. It's not somebody sitting on it.
I hear you. Okay. So once again, anybody who is listening on 146.25, the input frequency of this repeater, please go to reverse mode, so to speak, on your 146.85. Go to reverse mode. Tell us how strong the signal is and at what hour you heard it. And please report that to RFI at LIMOC.org. RFI stands for Radio Frequency Interference. So report it to RFI at LIMARC, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, LIMARC.org. Please report it there. So go up, give us the space report. And I think there was a launch this week. WS2F, KQRIW in the ZECNET.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So they're going to lower that for its investigation of the rarefied atmosphere of the moon. We drop it. Well, yeah, there was a launch there, same company, Orbital Sciences, launching from Virginia the Antares rocket. Second launch of the Antares rocket for them, they ran a test back in April, which was successful. They did not put a spacecraft on top. They put a dummy spacecraft, just a heavy spacecraft with a simulator with cameras and test equipment and all that. But this time they put the real thing, the Cygnus spacecraft that being built actually by a company in Italy, but they're building the service module that connects to it, you know, with the propulsion and avionics and all of that. They got about half the build of the Cygnus spacecraft put on top of the Antares, and it was launched to the International Space Station last Wednesday. I happened to be home. I was able to see it live on NASA TV. Same time we had at least two amps. I know getting down to the beach, or I think the St. Jones Beach, Matt, I forgot his call. He might be on listening, and another fellow name, I think his name was Jack. But, I heard them getting there, and with 20 minutes or so to spare, when I got on the radio, and I also gave John a call. John, this was almost 11 o'clock last Wednesday, KC2WGV, but you didn't answer. The other guys came back, so since they were driving, there was a few-minute delay. You know, when you see this thing go up, and you can see it in daylight, I mean, you're not going to see a rocket, but you're going to see the light from the flame and possibly a contrail.
By the way, was that Matt, KC2YDT, ball good?
Yeah, and I did try to write his call letter down. And he went on the, I think he was walking with an AC, I'm not sure, but he got on the that little bridge probably over there, and I lost him, and then one thing led to another, and I never did get his call. And he gave it to me a couple times as I was talking to him, but I never wrote it down. I had my one eye on the computer watching the pre-launch thing, like little documentaries about the Cygnus spacecraft and the Antares, you know, the two main engines that launched this thing, and pretty interesting. So I gave a quick countdown, 8 minutes, 6 minutes, 5 minutes, 2 minutes, that type of thing, and this way they knew, or anybody else that was out there trying to look, above the horizon, it turns out he did say it was about 13 degrees above the horizon. That's all you got to see from the New York area. You can do this all the way up to Maine, probably a couple of degrees, above the horizon. Naturally, the further you get away, and you see it go up, and then you see it drop because it's going southwest. It's they're sending that thing off to meet the International Space Station, which is at a 51.6 degree inclination. So it goes off basically to the south. Southeast, and so you look southwest, and you can see this thing. Not sure I did. I'm covered by trees. Got to be down by the water somewhere. So that was pretty interesting. As far as orbital, they're doing very good. This is their experimental flight up to the space station. They only got 1,300 pounds on when they're in operation. The next flight will be an official flight for them to prove to NASA that they can do it. They have almost a $2 billion contract over the next, I don't know how many years, I think through next 3 or 4 years to send unmanned rockets of cargo, 5,000 pounds roughly each flight, to the space station. So it's pretty good for them. It was supposed to dock today. They got near the space station. They have flight rules. They have to test different things. Spacecraft has to move. It has to go one way or the other way. They got to make sure it can do whatever it could do. It's got an abort system in case something goes wrong. It can get away from the space station. Whatever the problem was, it had to do with software. The Cygnus spacecraft wasn't hearing the signals properly from the space station. So it created an abort for 2 days, 48 hours. Soon after the problem, Orbital Science did come up with a fix. They found out what the problem was. They implemented that. But because of orbital mechanics, you know, the way it works as it's going around the Earth, they can't just pull right back in and do it, do the docking. So they have to wait the 2 days and get themselves lined up a little bit better, and then they'll be able to do that docking. So that was pretty good. So much for Cygnus. Just want to also thank John for sending YouTube about the comet theory. Very, very well done. I think almost an hour and a half documentary on that. It really upsets the whole, you know, this guy, Craig Whipple, came up with the, you know, many years ago, back in the 30s, of the snowball, the dirty snowball effect for comets, WS2N. This kind of blows that apart of everything that I heard was true. And he had to have about 10 different reasons and proof and used all the different scientific missions. He used Stardust, he used the impact flight that crashed into Temple 1. He used Stardust, the one that went to Vilt 2. And used all the different examples, the minerals that they brought back. And he pretty much showed that they can't really find any water on these comets. The tail and all, it shows that it's not really water vapor, it's other things. And it goes into just long, complicated things of what it really is. And very well done. And I'll be looking forward to see if this actually comes out to be true in the future. I mean, it seems that way. That maybe the comets do not really come from the Oort cloud. Maybe not the building blocks of the solar system. Just water and dust. Their theory is maybe it comes from exploding planets from eons ago. And because of the minerals that they detected and all these different like I said, a long explanation, but very well done, kind of proving that thought that they call them electron comet theory or something like that. But you can Google that and come up with what that means to planetary study and how things have evolved in the throughout the, not only solar system, but throughout the galaxy. That was pretty good. One other comment. A lot of flights have taken off this year. Only real one big one that's left. One they got one rebuild of the International Space Station that's not done yet. That was going to be at the end of the year. They're going to make that for February of next year. So there's really one big one left, and that's the MAVEN spacecraft that's going to be put into the orbit of Mars. The MAVEN, it stands for Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Spacecraft. And that's coming up in November. And that won't be launched from Virginia, but will be launched from Florida, from Cape Canaveral, on board an Atlas V rocket. So it's a big rocket, a bigger rocket than the Antares. This thing's about 200 feet tall, so it's the biggest one right now that NASA uses. And they'll be sending MAVEN to Mars. We'll get there in about 6 to 7 months, and we'll see how that goes. The idea is to study the atmosphere of Mars in detail. They have eight scientific experiments on board. We could always go into detail in the future. That's you want to tear each one of them apart. We could do that as well. That's pretty much it, Dick. As far as comets go, I think end of November, we could look for ISON, the International Scientific Optical Network comet. That's the one that's going to come very close to the sun, and we should see it for a couple of months, maybe even in the daytime if that works out. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Timing out the repeater. This is WS2N, Paul, from the space portion of the TechNet, and I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com, like John so graciously did last week. Back to you, Dick, WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. Let's see now. Electron comet theory is what you're saying is the words we can use to Google to get some more of the information about this thing. And for years and years, many astrophysicists, astronomers, believe that much of the water on planet Earth came from deposition from comets that hit the Earth. And of the particular comets they have measured recently, I believe you're saying that the water content seems to be very small. And now, my question is it because they just happened to find a dry comet to measure, or do they have good reason to believe that all comets have very little water? And maybe the amount of water on a comet required to properly make oceans on the Earth is not that great. If you got zillions and zillions of comets hitting the Earth over millions and millions of years, billions of years, Earth is around 4.5 billion years old, even if each one of them only has a few drops of water, that's going to all add up. So what's your feeling on the, have they bailed out on comets being the source of the water? WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Documentary did, and it was very well done, but, I mean, I haven't heard anything conclusive. Astronomy magazine or anything that's changed so far, they still call for the war on the comet theory. But according to this thing, this was pretty good. I mean, they studied stardust with the aerogel on board that actually brought material back to the Earth, launched in 1999, went to build two, and later on, it sent a craft back to Earth, landed in the Utah desert, and that's how they studied everything. But from that capsule I came back, but the mothership Stardust, they sent it off to another comet and to study it. Giotto, I think it was another one years ago, went out to Halley's comet. Found the scientific information around that, and they kept saying, where's the water? And they used, I didn't study it that hard, but theory that the comet is basically negatively charged, and it comes into a positive charged area near the sun, and different things happen. They have diagrams of what happens, and what you're really seeing is, John might remember, wasn't O, H, one hydrogen, one oxygen, it was something else, and they could prove that it was really coming from the silicon of the comet, and they did laboratory studies, and it was well done. It's one of those stories. They had the, and they timed out again. They had roughly a half a dozen spacecraft have gone to multiple into this Temple One, and then the results that came off of that, the electron comet theory, theorist, according to this documentary, came up right in the results that that was coming off the comet. So interesting study that went on there. So I want to thank John for that. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. The Ison comet is going to pass very, very close to the sun around November. As I see it, it could get very heated by the sun, do a whole lot of outgassing, make an extremely long, bright tail, and be maybe as bright as Halley's Comet was around 1910 or whatever it was. There was a mission of Halley's Comet in 1910 that was extremely bright. I don't think we've ever seen anything since then. Let me turn that down. So this comet, when it goes that close to the sun, could do a lot of outgassing, make a big tail. That's mission. That's a response number one. Response number two, it could decide to enter the sun's atmosphere, and we never see it again. Response number three, it could break up into a whole lot of little pieces, which may or may not be bright. So, of those three responses, are they still of the opinion, Paul, that it is likely to be that first response where a lot of outgassing, it survives, stays in one piece, and gives us a great big bright tail? Are they still hoping for that one? And will it be the comet of the century, so to speak, Paul? What's your guess on that one? WS2N, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. Well, according to some of the internet sites, I think it's going to hold together. I do have a magazine. What was the name of that thing? Space. I think it's just called Space, but it had a lot of different topics and covered that. It did cover that comet, and they're saying it's coming. It's going to go within 800,000 miles, that's close, to the sun. It doesn't, according to that magazine, they don't think it's going to survive. You know, they think it's going to be, you know, once around the merry-go-round, is the way I think of it. It's not going to be much left, so that when it comes back eons from now, I don't know when, you know, what its orbital period is, but whenever it comes back, it might not come back. Might not be much left to see. So I think it's going to go out in a big flash, according to what I'm reading. It should be pretty cool. I mean, from the 20, I think I read the 28th or 26th, I don't know. That's when it's closest to the sun, perihelion. And then another month, I think they said probably, I don't know, maybe the middle of January or something. So you're looking at it all of December, we're going to see this thing in the sky. And it's located. We look to, you know, for the Big Dipper. And you would follow the arc of the handle, and well, you know astronomy, Dick, but you know that points to Spica, and the Spica will be the location to look for that for that month period of time, Dick.
Do you know the number of millions of miles between Mercury and the Sun? Earth is 93 million miles. I'm going to guess that Mercury is in the vicinity of 30 million miles from the surface of the Sun. And if this thing is going to go 800,000 miles, it's 0.8 million. So this comet, Ison, comes within 0.8 million. And I'm going to guess Mercury is close to 30 million. So it's about 35 or 40 times closer to the Sun than Mercury. Do I have the numbers in the right ballpark, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, Mercury's a hot place. The sun, what, 800 degrees, I think. I think Venus is a little hotter because of the carbon dioxide atmosphere, but I've seen pictures of it. It looks like where craters were, that melted down. It looks like it's been heated with a blowtorch, and it's going to make. I thought it was 33 million, but you might be right. I know it's an 88-day orbit.
When it comes to Mercury, I really don't know. I just made a very rough guess that it's one-third of the distance of Earth, 93 million. That's how I came up with 30. So if you read somewhere that Mercury is 33 million, I'm going to believe it. And so this comet, 0.8 million versus 33 million for Mercury, gives you a little bit of a feeling. And you could tell me the name of the spacecraft that we sent in orbit around Mercury, or is in orbit around the Sun at roughly the distance of Mercury. And the heroic things we had to do to protect the spacecraft from the tremendous amount of solar energy that that spacecraft's going to get. It's the opposite problem of sending something out to Jupiter where you can't build the solar cells big enough, and therefore you have to put a nuclear power supply on board. You send something to the orbit of Mercury, and it gets some darn much solar energy. You've got to put a sun shield on it to try to keep it from melting down. What's the name of that spacecraft that I'm speaking of, Paul? WS2NK2RIW?
Yeah, that's still in orbit around Mercury. First time we did it, too. We had, back in, what, the 70s, you had a Mariner spacecraft go by, and actually went around the orbit again. You got more pictures. I think it was Mariner 10. And this is called Messenger, and it's in orbit, and it's got all kinds of heavy blanket insulation and everything to keep all the electronics and everything cool, and it's survived, and it's still doing science there, so that's pretty good. When you go out to Jupiter, with Galileo, that was a RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator system, as well as Cassini, Saturn. But they got better over the decades with the solar panels that we have a spacecraft now on the way to Jupiter called Juno, and it's got big panels. You know, your inverse square law really kicks in. I think that's, I don't know, each one is, there's three big panels. I forget what I was looking at. I think each one's 66 feet long or something. And it's now enough energy to operate that spacecraft. So, I mean, we got a little bit better at it. And the European Space Agency, they got one out there as well, by the asteroid field called Rosetta. And that's another one. These huge, ginormous solar panels. And that should be, actually, I've got a craft that's going to land on an asteroid many years from now, I think 2016. So they do that. I mean, but if you got any further than Jupiter, you better have an RTG. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, somebody asked for a comment. I'll get you in a second. Paul, if I'm sending a spacecraft to Jupiter, and I've got the choice of using a Gigunder, as you called it, a 66-foot-long solar panel to get enough solar energy way out there where the sun is very dim. If I got the choice of that versus a radioactive thermal generator, what in the world makes me reject the radioactive thermal generator? The radioactive thermal generator is going to give me electric power for the next, let me pick a number, 30 years. And to deploy, to pay the cost, find ways of folding it up, and properly deploy a set of solar panels 66 feet long. I mean, the degree of risk you've got with that, cost risk of proper deployment, and you've got to worry about the orientation of the spacecraft all the time. They've got to be aimed toward the sun, otherwise you get nothing. Whereas all of that goes away with thermal electric generator, a nuclear source. So I'm having trouble understanding what makes them reject a nuclear source. Why didn't they go that way? WS2N, K2LIW?
They didn't need it. It's only going to be a 33 orbit. It sounds like it's not much, but 33 orbits, I think, encompasses a couple of years. That's all they needed. No extended missions on that. It's a polar orbit of Jupiter. Basically studying the magnetosphere and lot of the atmosphere of Jupiter. That's really all they needed. Where Galileo, they were happy with that. I mean, because that went what must have went about 6, 7, 8 years or longer, and that went into an orbital, like an equatorial orbit. And that, you know, the reason for that, they wanted to study a lot of the moons, near all the moons, which were in that type of plane, and as well as Jupiter. And that thing had a craft that separated and went down to the atmosphere as well. Come to think of it, when I first got there. So they needed a long time spacecraft for that. They didn't have the capability of the very good solar panels, high efficiency. The capability of opening these things are really good now. So I think they were felt confident with Juno. And it's, this panel is 60 some odd feet, comes out from the center 120 degrees apart, one of those deals. And really kind of like end to end. It's really like probably like 120 feet or something. Back to you, Dick.
Boy, that's a biggie. I've got another question, but somebody had a question or a comment. Who was that? Give me your call letters and name and go right ahead. KQRIW in the TechNet space section.
WGB, I don't know if you can copy me.
WGB, I am copying you, so go right ahead, John. A little bit noisy, but with earphones, we can fill you out and I will repeat everything you say. You got it, John. Okay, I'm falling behind on my email, Paul. Hi, John. So, I think you said you mailed me something on the electric comet, and, in fact, maybe you mailed that last week. From 1 week to the next, I forget what I get. And so I got to go review. Okay, I'll look for that email, John, and I thank you. Anybody else with any further questions or comments before I ask another question to Paul? Give me your call letters right now. KQLIW and the Tech Man. And that is, I'm going to mention again that the most long-range radio contact that mankind has ever done, two-way radio contact, and the longest-range piece of hardware mankind has ever launched in all of our history, 4.5 billion years of history of this planet, and mankind launched something called Voyager 35 or so years ago, and Voyager has, you've been hearing the reports that it has just left the solar system. It no longer sees the solar wind as the dominant particles hitting it. It's now seeing galactic wind. It is outside of the heliosphere. And that thing is roughly 12 billion miles away. I think it's around 120 or 125 astronomical units. And I think that's approximately 12 billion miles. Let me double check with you. Am I in the right ballpark on the distance there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I think it's 120. I think Voyager 2 is 106. That's a lot longer way to go, but I think in a couple of years, I think it's going to be outside the heliosphere as well.
Okay, so Voyager number 1, roughly 12 billion miles away. Round trip communication time, I vaguely remember, is it 37 hours? In other words, you send a signal up there to Voyager and you say, please talk to me. And that signal comes back to you roughly 37 hours later. Is that roughly the number, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I've given up trying to memorize the round trip. I just go with 17. It's a little over. It's getting close to 18 now. Almost 18 hours one way.
There you go. So 17 or 18 hours one way at the speed of light for the signal to get there. And the spacecraft, it has no problem with frequency accuracy because the signal you send up is the signal you get back, cycle by cycle.
What the thing does is it takes the receiver, low noise amplifier, amplifies the signal from Goldstone that goes up there, gets there in 17 and a fraction hours at the speed of light. That's really down the road a piece. And multiplies that signal by 221 over 240. 240 over 220. Yeah, 221 over 240. That ratio, every cycle gets divided by, the downlink is lower than the uplink, so it gets divided by 240 and multiplied by 221. That ratio, that rational number, determines the exact frequency you get back. It is your own signal, offset by that ratio. That's the way the Goldstone, that's the way the deep space network works. Very crafty. So you literally can count every cycle of the RF that comes back versus the RF that you issued, and measure the time, and you can get range accuracy that's as good as your frequency accuracy of your system. It's another one of these examples where a good clock does magic. You can get range resolution of feet. In other words, that satellite, if somebody grabbed the satellite and wiggled it back and forth a couple of feet, it would make a few cycles of increase and decrease of what comes back, and you could measure that. So the range resolution is feet. The range accuracy is probably a small fraction of a mile out of 12 billion miles. What a system. But the clock accuracy is where the magic happens. Now, I'm going to tell you what happened last week that to me was very significant. Let me drop the call.
And they can also tell if the craft is angled off one way or another by that signal return system. So that's two things that they could do with that radio wave.
So that 14-foot diameter dish, I think it is giving you something in the vicinity of a tenth of a degree of beam width. And so that flashlight beam, that very narrow flashlight beam, got to be aimed directly at the Earth. So here we are 35 years downrange, and the ability of that satellite to steer its azimuth and elevation just right so that the dish is aimed at the center of the Earth from 12 billion miles away. And if it's not, I mean, all the gain of that dish goes down the tubes instantaneously. If, for instance, you had 1 degree of error, which would be 10 beam widths of error in pointing, all of that great gain would be go down by some ridiculous number of dB. It'd be 30 dB in the hole as opposed to getting communication. So I'm amazed that the inertial wheels, the celestial navigation, the whole system is continuing 35 years later to aim itself accurately to the nearest tenth of a degree in azimuth and elevation. Am I in the right ballpark here, Paul, for the US2N, K2LIW?
And they got a star tracker on board. I forget the name of the star. I think it begins with a C. But I'd have to look that up. It stares at this one star all the time, and it's got the sun. It's looking at the sun, so it's got a photo sensor on board that's actually looking through the 14-foot dish. I've got a hole in the dish, so they could have that look back at the Earth. Actually, it's at the sun, so they know that where that helps them point it accurately. So it's amazing. And this thing, and nobody's going to grab it anytime soon, of course. I know you're using that as an example, but even if they could, they'd better be going 40,000 miles any hour away from the Earth or away from the sun. That's how fast this thing is going. And it's roughly 3 AU per year, 3 AU per year. So it's getting there. Before you know it, wait about 40,000 years, and it's going to be near another star.
Okay, you're keeping track of Voyager a little bit better than I am, for sure. Have they made any prediction for life of the traveling wave tube, life of the thermoelectric nuclear generator, life of the pointing system, funding of NASA to keep aiming the Goldstone dish at there and getting some signals from it? Is anybody predicting roughly how much longer the Voyager mission will last? In other words, in the year 2020, will Goldstone likely still be tracking Voyager and finding out what the cosmic rays are like out there at, let me pick a number, instead of 120 astronomical units,
it'll be 200 astronomical units. Had they made a prediction for how many more years they can squeeze out of that particular mission, and that spacecraft survive and still have enough reaction fuel on board in order to keep planting that pencil beam accurately to the Earth? How long is this one going to last, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, I know you want to get to your clock story, but yeah, Ed Stone, he was with them originally when the thing took off, project manager for JPL, for Voyager, both Voyager spacecraft, and naturally he's no kid right now, but he's still heavily involved with the project. He does a lot of interviews regarding the topic, and last time I heard him, he said 23 watts of power coming out of the that traveling wave tube. What it started off with, I don't know. I tried to find that data. I couldn't do it. But it's down to 23 watts. It's going to last. The thermocouples and all that, it might eventually fail and drop. Who knows when that might fail, but they think the battery recharging and the the basic electronics for the RTG, the radioisotope, thermoelectric generator, they're hoping to get to 2025, so they'll be happy to get that far, Dick. Signal-wise, no problem, because, you can figure out how many AUs that is. What, I said three per year, and figure another 10 years, 30, maybe another 30 or so AU, let me drop it. I mean, if it went another 35 years instead of another 10 years, that would be doubling the distance. And then you could get down to 25% of the power would be left coming back. We're going back to it. That might be serious. But they don't think it's going to go that long. So you won't have a signal problem, but, receiving and transmitting, because, it's not going to be that much of a difference between where it is now 10 years from now. Back to you, Dick.
What's your best guess, Paul? When they launched Voyager, they expected it to be a how-many-year mission. Was that expected to be, let me pick a number, a 10-year mission? And here we are 35 years downrange. What was the original projection for life and the definition of success? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
I remember that when it went up, I followed that. That was right around actually soon after the Viking mission in 76. So it was pretty cool. They had plenty of money left from the manned space program going to the moon, and there was a lot of money, momentum involved to launch all those crafts, Pioneers, Voyages, Vikings. And I remember back then saying that, after it gets to Neptune, they plan on having this thing, it's going to keep on going, and it's going to keep reporting back what's out there, because it will be the, furthest, after time, because they knew it was going to go faster than the Pioneers, even though the Pioneers were launched first. They knew that these two would be the first craft to actually leave the solar system. They talked about it then. Carl Sagan talked quite a bit about it in his books. Back to you, Dick.
Well, once again, Paul, was there a rough prediction in the beginning as to how many years it would last to be considered successful? Was anything beyond 10 years or 12 years considered gravy, if you know what I mean? K2LAW?
I know they were happy if it was going to make it to the late 1980s. From the 1980s, I think they got out to Neptune. That's what they, it was their, that was the time frame. That's what they really cared about. Anything after that was gravy.
Hey, okay, so launch in 36, late 80s, 10, 12 years is what they expected, and here we are 35 years downrange. And if it lasts till the year 2025, which is what you're speculating is possible, and if it
now twice the number of astronomical units away. It's around 120 astronomical units now, and you double that, the universe, the inverse square law says every time you double the distance, you get one quarter of the power, 6 decibels less. And can they listen to a signal 6 decibels weaker? I think the answer is absolutely yes. They're right now getting it, they had enough foresight to tell it, to give it the ability to be commanded in the bit rate. You can tell it, okay, talk to me now, Voyager, but don't talk to me any faster than this number, otherwise I may not get it. I think they're getting down to around 150 bits per second right now is the bit rate of communication. When it's at twice the distance, one quarter of the signal, they'll have to go to one quarter of that, which is, around 40 bits per second. So if they command it to talk back at 40 bits per second, they'll get the exact same signal-to-noise ratio, if the power output is the same, when it's at twice the range. That's a very crafty system. By making the bit rate smaller, you can set your phase lock loop of the receiver at Goldstone. Let me drop. You set the receiver more narrow, bigger integration factor, which gives you the same amount of signal per se, but one quarter the amount of noise. And therefore everything comes back to normal. Just by changing the bit rate at which it communicates. Very crafty system. So as long as you got the right kind of a clock, as long as you've got enough accuracy in the phase lock loop of your receiver, enough accuracy of the master oscillator that does the transmitting, then all of this comes together. As you can see, the magic of a good clock really is something worth seeking. We drop. So that gives you a hint as to what happened last week that I thought was so significant. And how this all started is that Mr. Spagnoli, can't remember his first name, if Eric is there, he'll tell me Mr. Spagnoli's first name. He's the guy that did arguably the most amount of research on the standard for digital television we're using in the United States, the 8VSB, 8 Vestigial Sideband Technique. The good news of that technique is that you take the 6 megacycle bandwidth of one television channel, instead of one piece of program material going there, you can squeeze in 6, 7, or 8 pieces of program, a couple of audio channels, you can squeeze a whole lot of stuff in there. The picture itself, as long as your digital demodulator is working correctly, you get a snow-free picture, and in some cases, high-resolution, snow-free, 16:9 aspect ratio picture. Beautiful-looking thing, essentially as good as a 35-millimeter slide, essentially as good as what you see in a movie theater. Let me drop. That's the good news. And they did run a couple of experiments in a number of cities in the United States. And if you know how you're reading the data, you can find out that they didn't say it in words, but I can tell by the way I read the data, they knew that they would have a lot of trouble with impulse noise on channels 2, 4, and 5, 2, 4, 5, and 6. So the lower VHF channels are going to be getting a whole lot impulse noise. As you go up in frequency, the same amount of sparking of your power line gives you less and less power. It falls off 60 dB per octave. Or maybe it's 12 dB per octave. There's at least 60 dB per octave. You go to high enough frequency, the same amount of sparking gives you less noise. So the upper VHF frequencies are where the digital television system works. The next thing they didn't really figure out, in my opinion, was that it also is extremely vulnerable to multipath. I've seen a demonstration given to me by Eric where he's got an antenna on a tower at a nice high location, and in order to get a clean signal with not too much multipath, he had to do some minor steering of the television aerial. So that, in theory, if you're a serious television watcher for UHF television, even though you think you've got line of sight to the Empire State Building and the new Freedom Tower, you still would like to have a rotator on your antenna so that you can carefully tune those side lobes and notches of the antenna pattern. All television aerials have it. And if you can tune some of those notches in the direction of the major multipath that occurs in your neighborhood, maybe it's the water tower, maybe it's an adjacent building, then you get a hell of a lot better digital signal with less inter-symbol distortion, and therefore the multipath essentially goes away if you've got a rotator. Let me drop. But we were virtually promised that we went from analog television to digital television, we'd have approximately the same range. And it wasn't intentional, but in my opinion, that turned out to be a lie. It wasn't intentional. Everyone believed it. But when you get to the real world in a real metro area, analog television people used to be able to watch a slightly snowy picture at 60 miles. I think there are very few people in the New York City area, east of New York City on Long Island, very few people beyond 20 miles are getting as good a television reception reliability as they'd like to have. Certain nights of the week, Channel 2, what's called Channel 2, which is really, I think, Channel 33, is not there. Because Mother Nature's multipath that particular night is a little bit too strong. And that's the kind of jazz that I'm running into, and I'm not alone. And I'm on a high piece of land with a direct line of sight to New York City, and I'm not getting clean television digital reception all the time. The catch is that you've got lots and lots of information by this very fancy modulation technique that can be squeezed into 6 megacycles. Let me drop. But all of that fancy demodulation with all of that data crashes immediately if you lose the clock. And the method by which the system maintains the clock, in my opinion, is not as robust as you'd like it to be. And yes, you could design, you could dedicate more and more energy of the transmission to being clock synchronization, but now you'd be using less and less energy for the actual data being transmitted, and you wouldn't be able to transmit as many channels with as many high-definition bits, if you know what I mean. So it's a compromise. So the vulnerability of the system is if it loses the clock, it crashes. And although Joe asked that very innocent question last week, and we're talking about KC2QIW, was asking about the loss of our frequencies, and we eventually started talking about digital television and the change of those frequencies and the change of the mode of modulation going from analog to digital. We now realize that if you have an external means of maintaining that clock, I believe that a digital television converter, demodulator, can now tolerate tremendous amounts of distortion due to multipath, impulse noise, and whatever. And you then have the ability to start entering that area of synchronous demodulation that's being used by WSJT. The weak signal Joe Taylor techniques has the equivalent of a synchronized clock with the equivalent of synchronous demodulation. And as such, it can listen to a signal 28 dB of negative signal-to-noise ratio. It can demodulate that signal and write the message across the screen. KE2EJ, this is K2LIW, if you know what I mean. Beautiful system. So there's a huge advantage in synchronizing a clock. And in the past, people used to think that, okay, you could do that by a global positioning separate receiver for your digital television. And that in turn disciplines a master oscillator that gives you a good clock. And we used to think, well, that would be an expensive approach. Well, are you sure? Let me drop.
KC2IS.
Essentially every single cell phone these days has a GPS receiver on board. And the GPS receiver only works if it's got an accurate clock. So that little chip that's doing all that work in all of our cell phones ain't that expensive because of the mass production. Would you be willing to put that chip into your digital converter for your television set so that now you can get, let me pick a number, 50 miles, 60 miles of range of digital television, which would quadruple the area east of New York City that is able to watch digital television? That's a very small cost increase, and that's part of what came out of that set of discussions that went on for 2.25 hours last Sunday night, September 15th. And I'd like to believe sometime in the future we're going to add that clock synchronization technique so that we get back to the range we used to have with digital television. And I, for one, it's a pride thing. I've never had cable television. Everybody has cable television. They want a zillion channels, even though they only watch a few of them. And I like over-the-air broadcast. To me, it is an American tradition. Let me drop. Over-the-air broadcast television, to me,